Hello, this is Robert Ambrose, KPTZ Board President and host of Rhythm Connection. Like you, I'm waiting to hear Dr. Locke's weekly COVID-19 update. I depend on KPTZ to hear this crucial information because it allows me to better understand how the virus is affecting our community. It also helps me gauge when I might see my distant new grandson. You'd depend on KPTZ to hear Dr. Locke too, and KPTZ depends on you to keep broadcasting. Please consider clicking on the Donate Now button at kptz.org to give us your support for our efforts. Thank you.
KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners weekly meeting in progress for this week's public health updates, held as a virtual meeting during the COVID pandemic. Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Tom Locke and Department of Emergency Management Director Willie Bentz will now brief our commissioners and you, our KPTZ listeners.
And I will both respond after our public health update, which typically goes from 9:45 until about 10:20, 10:30. But we will largely save deliberation till 1:30 this afternoon at the same Zoom link. There will not be another public comment opportunity though until next Monday. So it is 9:45. Sorry to switch gears abruptly, but we have our listeners at KPTZ joining us. Welcome to Dr. Locke, Willie Bentz. Hope you had a nice weekend, and I'll hand it over to you.
Okay, well, thank you and good morning. So we had a busy weekend on the COVID front. Starting with the nationally, rates continue to go down, not quite as fast as they were previously, but still another 29% decreased nationally, and significant decrease in hospitalizations and death rates, you know, in the 20% range on both of those nationally. On the not good news, vaccination rates have been slowing down nationally. We were at about 3.3 million a day in April, and now we're at about a third of that nationally, 1.1 million a day, which is still a significant rate, but not as high as we'd like it to be. And where America as a whole is, about 43% of the population is now fully vaccinated, and 52% have had at least one dose. That's not evenly distributed around the country, though. There are some states where the vaccination rate is much lower, and not coincidentally, these are also the states that are starting to see increases in COVID rates again. So there's 8 states specifically, Alabama, Arkansas, Texas, Utah, Wyoming, several others, where rates are starting to go up again. And more we're seeing that correlation between rates of vaccination and rates of COVID-19 activity. We're seeing it in Washington State as well. And it's exactly what we would expect to see, given how this works. Washington State has had a significant drop, 49% drop in case rate over the last 2 weeks, which is good news. Although hospitalizations haven't budged, they're actually up just a tiny bit, and the death rate has only gone down a little bit by 6%. So we're still on average 8 people die every day in Washington State of COVID-19. And that's a number we would really like to be zero. We did hear some concerns on Friday from the state epidemiologists that they see some flattening in the decline in rates around the state, so that we seem to be plateauing at our current level. And we had really hoped to get to much lower levels over the course of June than where we are now. In Jefferson County, the avid readers of the New York Times will notice we are reported to as having a 300% increase in cases in Jefferson County. And that in fact is true. That we have jumped from a very low level to a higher levels. So in this last 2 weeks, we have 18 cases. So the first week of the month, we had four cases. And then this in the second week, we had 14 cases. Eight of them were over this weekend. So we had a very busy weekend. That brings our case total for the 2 weeks to 18. And the case rate is 56.4. And that's up from 15.7. So indeed, it's a 300 plus rate. It's comparable to what's going on elsewhere in the rate region. So Clallam County is at 62 cases per 100,000, and Kitsap County is at 73, which is actually good news because they've come to, way down from where they were even a few weeks ago. And a lot of our exposures in the past have occurred in Kitsap County. Now, however, they're occurring within the county in clusters of largely unvaccinated individuals. And that unfortunately is something we've anticipated. And we have to warn people about is that not only does the risk remain if you're unvaccinated, there's still plenty of COVID around that you can be exposed to. And as I said before, that it's mostly what is now known as the Alpha variant, the UK variant, which is considerably more infectious. So if you're exposed to it, you're more likely to get it. And I think that risk is going to not stay the same. It's going to increase as Washington State moves away from its COVID restrictions, as there are more people in indoor spaces and not wearing masks. If you're unvaccinated, your risk will go up, maybe substantially up over the months ahead. And so that's something to seriously factor in if you're still on the fence and considering whether to get vaccinated or not. On vaccination totals, Jefferson County is still way up there, second highest rate in the state in terms of fully vaccinated population. So 62% of Jefferson County residents are fully vaccinated now. 65% have had at least one dose. Only San Juan County has better statistics than that. Although King County is really catching up. And that's great news. And King County's rates are really dropping as well. You know, King County was in the 200 to 300 rate about a month ago. Now they're 70 cases per 100,000 in King County, even lower in Seattle. In fact, Seattle has the lowest COVID rate, the highest vaccination rate of any major metropolitan area in the country. So hats off to them. They're doing a fabulous job. And that impacts us. You know, we are all connected together in this state. We all move around. And so it makes a difference what other people are doing. So I just say my big messages today are, yeah, this is becoming the tale of the two epidemics. And the increasing fully vaccinated populations, it's a lot of good news. Rates are dropping, risks are dropping, it's becoming safe to discontinue masking and distancing and resume your social life, and soon there'll be a lot of more activities that will be opening up. And we're tracking breakthrough infection rates very carefully, and they appear to be very low. The current breakthrough rate among those who are vaccinated is 0.04%. So 4 cases in 10,000 is is a very low breakthrough rate. There is no vaccine that's 100% effective, but you know this is proving to be a very highly effective vaccine. And then the other epidemic is amongst the unvaccinated, and it is proceeding unabated from where it was in January. It's never dropped. I'll go into this in more detail with the Board of Health this Thursday. But we are still fighting that epidemic and bracing for the fact that it could get worse as opportunities for exposure to COVID among the unvaccinated increase. We could see higher rates. We don't think there's any way we will get back to where we were in January at the peak of all of this, nor will we have the hospitalization rates or the death rates that we've had in the past. But it'll still be a significant problem. We had three hospitalizations over this weekend. One got transferred out. One was discharged, fortunately. But one is in the hospital as of now. So we will be seeing more of that. And then I finally remark on testing. Testing is changing. We're trying to change from this kind of emergency response mode that we've been in into something that's a lot more sustainable and long-term and accessible to people. The only place you can get tested is to come to Port Townsend. We would like testing to be available everywhere around the county. And what's going to prove key to increasing availability of testing is using the rapid testing technologies that are getting out there. So we'll be we're doing more rapid tests in clinics. We'll be doing a lot in schools. Already doing them for sports Washington State has received hundreds of millions of dollars to support testing in schools in this coming year. And that's going to be a key way that we can bring schools back to full in-person model is through testing and controlling transmission that way. And then home testing is really starting to take off. What are known as the Binax Now self-tests are readily available. It costs about $20 for two tests. And people are buying them and they're using them, which is great. They're not always telling us when they test positive, which is not good, because we although it's not required, it's a voluntary thing. There are a lot of advantages to following the instructions on the package and actually notifying the local health department. There's a lot of things we can do to help. We can help people access services and learn what they need to prevent spreading the infection to others and learn when they need to be concerned and get medical evaluation. We have these blood oxygen monitors, oximeters that we loan out to people so they can monitor their own symptoms. We can arrange for help with quarantine and other services. So there's a lot of benefit to being involved in public health efforts to control transmission. But we're going to have to, that will be one of our challenges moving forward, is we'll have to earn people's trust and provide incentives for people to voluntarily report the results of these home tests that they now do, and they're in control of the results. But the reason these home tests were approved is that it's thought that this will be a net positive. The benefit we will get from more testing and people knowing whether they're infected or not will outweigh any disadvantage of people, not disclosing that information to people they should. So that's it for my update. Have about five questions from KPTZ. This week, and then Willie's got a couple. He's on a streak here. But anything from the commissioners first?
Greg?
Sure. We had public comment today about concern looking at the VAERS numbers, and there, I don't know, he flashed his screen up, but there were 5,000 reported deaths or something, some number like that. And can you explain a little bit how VAERS works and if that number actually reflects danger of the vaccine?
Yeah, VAERS is a very important tracking system for all vaccines. So it wasn't just set up for COVID. And where anything that happens after a vaccination is potentially reportable, and that, not just by healthcare professionals, but anyone who wants to report into it. And so, yes, there, you know, we have about 8,000 people die every day in the U.S. And a lot of them, you know, almost half of them now have gotten COVID vaccine. So we're inevitably going to have temporal associations between people get a vaccine and then after the vaccine, they die. So far, there have been zero cases of fatality from a COVID vaccine in the U.S. where there's been a proven causal link. So, and that doesn't mean it's impossible. It's just that, you know, in all the investigations that have done and the safety monitoring, we have yet to find anyone who's died from the vaccine. We do know there, you know, people who have had serious complications from allergic reactions, but none of those have been fatal. They've all been successfully treated. And there are concerns with a clotting disorder with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which is rare. It's not absolutely established that it's caused by the vaccine, but it may be associated. It's not fair to say there are no vaccines that are 100% safe, and there never will be. You know, anytime you stimulate the immune system, you run the risk of the immune system overreacting. But compared to other vaccines we have and we use, the COVID vaccines are turning out not only to be extraordinarily effective, but extraordinarily safe. You know, we've given the vaccine to approaching, I think it's like 120 million people now in the U.S. have gotten the vaccine, and with very few adverse reactions. So VAERS does not establish a cause and effect relationship, but it's an important system. And we report, any unusual reaction after vaccinations, we report it to VAERS. That's the responsible thing to do.
Great, thank you. And if I can, one other quick question, this also is kind of for a resident that was concerned. I've had a couple conversations with them and just feels like initially we used CDC as kind of a hallmark of this is the science, and now we're skewing and being more conservative than the CDC recommendation. And can you explain some of this state and county nuance for and that decision-making tree?
Yeah, it's I think even the CDC regrets how their advice was interpreted. You know, what they were trying to get out the good news that the vaccines are very effective and protect the fully vaccinated. It was not their intent, and I've heard this from CDC officials, that they did not want to encourage unvaccinated people to be mingling with other unvaccinated people indoors without masks. But that was one of the unintentional consequences of the way the decision rolled out. And people kind of used it as an excuse to more or less abandon masking. And we're trying to avoid that unintentional consequence in Jefferson County and do things a little more deliberately and say that it's very important right now, where we still got COVID circulating in the community, that unvaccinated people not be sharing air with people in indoor spaces and without a mask on. And I personally don't think it's fair to have business owners be the police who determines who's vaccinated or not. So that's the whole rationale behind that. In King County's and San Juan and others are doing a similar thing, but we see it as transitional and temporary. And by the end of the month, it's not our intention to keep doing this. You know, where it looks like we are going to transition to being a state with very few indoor COVID restrictions. There will, however, be in the workplace. So under occupational health and safety rules, there will be requirements to mask if you're unvaccinated in certain workplace settings. I think that's going to continue. And in healthcare settings, and for reasons I'll explain in a moment, we will be continuing to mask for a long time into the future.
Thanks. And one more, and I promise I'll be done. I just heard on the way in today, a lawsuit down in Houston, I think, about a hospital that mandated vaccinations for their employees and got sued, has won. I'm not suggesting any mandated vaccines, but I know a lot of different businesses are considering that and what their rights are and what workers' rights are. And I was wondering if you could, I guess, pontificate on that decision for us and give your analysis.
Yeah, maybe it is pontification at this point, but it's the law is kind of being investigated on this and tested. And so far, it's very strongly on the side of employers have a right to mandate vaccination if there is a significant patient safety issue or worker safety issue. And the law has been that way for a long time. And so the law does not support people who don't want to get vaccinated as part of their job. The law looks at that, you're not being coerced to have the vaccine. You're just not allowed to work in that job if you're not vaccinated, is how the law looks at it. And a sort of a companion thing, people think that, you know, they have a right to keep this information, if they're vaccinated or not, is somehow private health information. And it's not. The law doesn't support that. An employer has a right to ask you what your vaccination status is, because that information is necessary for them to protect your health. I predict there are going to be vaccination mandates in healthcare settings, maybe in other areas too, but the patient safety argument in healthcare system settings is just overwhelming. And the mission, the prime directive of a healthcare facility is to not harm their patients. So if we have a technology that allows us to do that, we have to use it. It's ethically, it's not a voluntary thing.
Heidi?
Greg asked one of my questions, but a follow-on is, I anticipate a bunch of confusion in a couple of weeks when we are part of this conversation every week and have been keeping our finger on the pulse, but the public clearly isn't as tuned to this as we are. I'm wondering if there's any plan for an education campaign, or like in the beginning of COVID, the whole mask up posters that were all over town. And just, I'm feeling like we might need to support our community. And I thank you for responding to my constituent question last week about using vaccination cards as proof of vaccination to enter a business. But I feel like we're gonna have the full range of interest in masking and vaccinations. And we need some kind of clear message that we can take to the community. And I don't know what plan is in place for that.
Well, we're really working on it. And I think there's gonna be a range of possibilities. I'm really encouraging people to look, especially with events, look at vaccinated only events. Because we know them to be very safe. They're also legal. They're legal now to have full capacity, fully vaccinated events. Businesses, at least in my opinion, have the right to still require that. If they want to require proof of vaccination as a condition for entering a space without a mask, that's within their rights to do. And I'd be willing to support that in whatever way I can. But I agree, there's going to be confusion, and I hope the state kind of does a better job of clarifying some of these things. They really are working on it. They understand behind the scenes that things were kind of done precipitously, and they've been trying to correct that as much as possible to prevent the unintended consequences. What I'm especially concerned about is the risks involved in some of these high density activities. You know, as we go back to full density restaurants and movie theaters and all of that, there's some real risks there, and we'll do our best to mitigate them, but we can't protect people to the same degree that they were being protected in the past. And that's something I don't think is fully sunk in to those that are unvaccinated, is the community has been protecting them from exposure. And some of that protection, maybe most of that protection, is going to go away pretty soon. So they have to start protecting themselves, that if they choose not to be vaccinated, they not only need to keep masking, they should even consider higher quality masks, you know, N95 and KN95, which are more protective of an individual who's susceptible to COVID.
Thank you, Dr. Locke.
I'll just, I don't have a question, but just a shout out of how wonderful it was to be able to have high school graduations this weekend. I only attended the Port Townsend one, but the combination of both a pretty high vaccination rate for the high schoolers and staff, as well as the community, but then also public health offering testing to all the kids, made it possible for them to have an unmasked, hug-filled day and evening together. And it was, I mean, the whole town really turned out to cheer these kids on. It was really heartwarming and made possible by public health. So thank you. Okay, should we go to KPTZ questions and then to Willie?
Yeah, and I've answered at least a part of these. One question was sort of asking if their daughter is immunosuppressed and they're fully vaccinated, what is the risk of transmission? It's actually very low. I quoted the statistics on breakthrough infection, so that's rare in the first place. And then we know that people that are fully vaccinated, if they have a breakthrough infection, they shed much less virus. Nonetheless, if someone is fully immunosuppressed and susceptible, you can't be too careful. So it never hurts to, even if you're fully vaccinated, to wear a mask around someone who's immunosuppressed. That's what I would do. That's certainly what we do in healthcare settings. There was kind of a technical question asking, you know, we lump zero and 19 age group case reports together, and could we do them in, you know, 10-year increments? And we've been kind of following the state reporting conventions, but yes, we can parse them in different ways. We have all the data. We can recategorize it, and in fact, we've been looking at that. We've been asking ourselves the question: what of this information is really useful to people in terms of making decisions? So something we started doing this week, we're working on publishing the case reports more with more geographical information. We have enough cases. We don't think we're going to violate anyone's privacy, but to give people a better idea of where the cases are occurring around the county. And I think, yes, we can give more information about age groups, and it's becoming relevant because it's, you know, right now we can't vaccinate the under 12 age group. And so that they're a susceptible group through no choice or fault of their own. So tracking cases in that age group is really important to us. There was a question that asked, of the various measures that have been used, which are best to sort of determine whether you have a transmission or what the transmission risk is, you know, what's safe to do and what's not. And they listed four things: the cases per 100,000, percent positivity, percent vaccinated, and then the hospitalization rate in an area. And I would put percent vaccinated is right now, that's one of the very best ways to determine what if you're in an area that's relatively high or low risk for transmission. And number two is the case rate. So cases per 100,000 that we report in 2 week cycles. Percent positivity is becoming less and less valuable because it has a lot to do with how many tests are done. And so we generally, it's low percent positivity or high percent positivity doesn't mean a lot. Hospitalization rates are significant, but they're kind of a tip of the iceberg measure. So the bigger the tip of the iceberg is, the likely, you know, the whole iceberg is larger. But really vaccination rates and case rates are the most important ways to predict transmission risk. And then there was actually two linked questions. The last two questions were kind of linked to what's the status of vaccination among medical professionals and dentists and optometry clinics and how can we track where are the safer facilities? And right now, none of that information is publicly accessible, although that's likely to change. There's the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, that regulates healthcare facilities. They have a rule in development to require hospitals to start publishing their COVID vaccination rates. So that's likely coming. And how many health facilities that will cover is yet to be known. It's a significant number, and we in public health we actually urge people to be proactive and publish their numbers, but we don't have any way of legally compelling it. We don't have any good recent studies on what the rates are nationally or statewide, but they're not as high as we would like. We're in some studies, we're only seeing about 50% vaccination among staff and long-term care facilities, and in the 80% or so range in most other healthcare facilities. But it is going up, and what we would really like to see is in the high 90s, 90, 95% rate. We are public about our rate at Jefferson County Public Health. We have a 94% vaccination rate at Jefferson County Public Health. All of our frontline workers are fully vaccinated, and we would like it to be 100%. That should be the goal of all healthcare facilities. Fortunately, even though you don't currently know the rate at healthcare facilities, there are a lot of other safety protocols in place in terms of infection control and masking and very rigorous testing of any healthcare workers who are exposed to confirmed cases. So we don't really see transmission in healthcare settings these days. We've done, I think, a very good job of preventing, making healthcare facilities a safe place to get health services. But we still, as I mentioned earlier on the context of mandatory vaccination, I consider it a patient safety issue, and I don't think there's a good reason not to be vaccinated if you're a healthcare professional, unless you are allergic to the vaccine itself. And that fortunately is a very rare thing. So that's it for my KPTZ questions.
Great. Thank you. Hello, Willie.
Hello, hello.
How are things at emergency management?
So for us, just this past week, just a couple of follow-up second dose events. I think the big thing that we've added to this schedule is that next is that Wednesday on the 23rd, so not this this Wednesday, but the following Wednesday, we'll be at the Tri-Area Food Bank there in Chimicum from 9:30 to 2. We'll have both J&J and Moderna for that. And you don't need to be receiving food bank services that day to receive the vaccine. So you can still go to the Jefferson County Public Health site or call into our call center 344-9791 and sign up for an appointment that way. But we're really hoping that folks coming through accessing food bank services will take advantage of that opportunity. And again, we'll have both J&J. So if you want a single dose, you can come in, get the one dose and be done with it. Or if you want the two series Moderna, which does offer you a little bit higher level of protection being a two dose vaccine, you can have that as well. Then we'll be back out about a month later to follow up with that series. So 23rd, again, 9:30 to 2, sign up the usual ways to, we really do hope to see some folks out there. Other than that, we're continuing with our survey activities and trying to target a few more of these last additional pop-ups for some of our underserved populations over the next couple of weeks. My KPTZ questions, and Dr. Locke's right, I am on a little bit of a roll, so do keep them coming. One question was about booster doses. And as we've talked a little bit before, you know, we do expect there to be a need for booster doses about 9 to 12 months after you complete the initial vaccine series. So I'm seeing as how some of our frontline healthcare workers, our first responders, you know, they received their first dose about December, January. So we're expecting that there to be a need for booster doses later this year, likely sometime very late fall into winter at the earliest. And so the KPTZ question specifically was, do you see a need for mass vaccination clinics yet again once booster doses become available, become in demand? And absolutely, you'll be able to receive booster doses in the same way you can get vaccinated now, likely at pharmacies through your primary care provider. But you know, we're gonna want folks to get boosted en masse. So those large vaccination clinics like the drive-through at Jefferson Healthcare, which we have an agreement we'll be able to use at DEM and Public Health. We'll also look at some of our previous delivery options. So yeah, we're likely to see some of those big mass vaccination events. Fortunately, this go around, the vaccine won't be as limited a resource as it was early on in the pandemic. It won't be quite an urgent rush to get everyone the booster dose as it was to get them vaccinated in the first place as soon as possible. But still, the more folks we can get that booster dose in a short amount of time, the better. So we're likely to see some of those larger clinics, again, probably sometime this winter. The second question for me dovetails into that, and that concerns our whole core of volunteer nurses and doctors who have been helping out and helping to make these both mass vaccination clinics and pop-up clinics possible. And yet we hope we're going to be keeping them on as volunteers. We're hoping they'll stick with us and be ready and available when booster doses come. But there is the question of whether or not the authorization of the PrEP Act, which allows volunteers to deliver vaccine, will still be active at that time. And that's something I really don't know for sure. I'm really hoping that, because they're, you know, will be still part of the ongoing emergency response, and they've been such a critical component of our response. I'm really hoping that that PrEP Act authorization will still be in place, we'll still be able to use volunteers. But if not, we'll bring them on as employees and jump through the necessary hoops to be able to make that happen regardless. So again, can't say for sure whether or not we'll still be able to use them as volunteers, but we're committed to making those booster dose clinics happen one way or the other. So expect to see those in a little bit. Other than that, that's the end of my report, barring any questions from the commissioners.
I would just say I saw the food bank vaccination clinic pop up on Nextdoor. So the word's getting out, Willie.
Good. Excellent.
Willie, could you maybe quickly give the hotline number, and also is our drop-ins possible at the food bank clinic?
Okay, so our hotline number is area code 360-344-9791. And at the food bank clinic on the 23rd, walk-ins are indeed welcome at that clinic. So again, that's at the Tri-Area Food Bank in Chimicum, 9:30 to 2. We'd really like, if at all possible, for you to schedule an appointment. That helps us gauge numbers a little bit better. And, you know, we know when the appointments are, so we know what kind of rhythm to expect a little bit. But again, walk-ins are indeed welcome, appointments encouraged, but we're happy to see you one way or the other.
Great, thank you. Greg, Mark, any questions for Willie or Dr. Locke? Okay. And I anticipate with both, you know, some changes coming at the end of the month and just public health's desire to be working on the messaging that Commissioner Eisenhower was mentioning, that we'll be talking about that in our meetings in the next couple of weeks, and, you know, try to be, it's complicated because we want to help prepare the public and the business community for changes, but we don't know what they are. So that that messaging is tricky to be thinking about. There will also be some changes to testing and to the hospital's COVID hotline. So we will be unrolling that in the next week or two. Stay tuned for updates on that. All right, anything else before we sign off for the day? Okay, well, thank you, good. Dr. Locke, yeah. Willie, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks.
So let's see.
This is KPTZ Port Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of Commissioners meeting. A recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. Thank you for listening and for supporting your local community radio station. To make a donation to KPTZ, please visit kptz.org.
And don't forget, a recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. And again, thank you to the commissioners, thank you, Dr. Locke, and thank you, Willie Bentz, and thank you, our listeners.